all kinds of interesting guys in this hobby. I'm a big fan of software-defined radios, and one of the nice things is that they are can be operated on a big computer screen, and they can show you pan adapters, and you can see all throughout the band. I can use my Flex 6700 and my main monitor, and I could display all of HF in all of its beauty. I probably go on a little bit too long. And there's one old-timer guy, nice guy, but you know, he said, yeah, you don't look for signals. You listen for signals. You put your headset on and you twirl the VFO. That's how you get a signal. You don't go looking for things on a screen. So it takes all kinds. It's funny damn fun.
There's an old expression, there are a thousand ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, but you know, people get used to particular ways, and they feel comfortable with those ways, and if you suggest that they use a different way, upset. When people get used to things, I guess there's a good thing to that, but there's a bad thing to that, because you never try anything new, and so you might have accidentally found the best way of doing things, but you may not have.
There's no right and no wrong.
Now, there's a lot of wrongs. I mean, there was a guy a while ago on the technical net who used to give advice that was kind of one of those things that 80% of the time it would work out fine. 20% of the time, your rig would blow up. So Dick K2RIW would tend to bookend this guy's advice with a precautionary tale. So there's a lot of ways of doing it incredibly dangerously wrong.
KF2CC here. No, what I meant is that there are a lot of ways to skin a cat. You could do things, their way, that achieved the exact same result if you did it your way. It's a matter of preference.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is more than one way of safely, correctly doing something. Some are a little bit better than others in different ways. But again, there are also terrible ways of not to do things. They used to have things on television called the Darwin Awards, where they would videotape people doing unwise acts, like they were taking down a wall without bothering to realize that it was a structural supporting wall that kept the house from falling in on itself. Or they wouldn't bother to notice that inside the wall was a gas main, and they would just kind of hit it with a hammer until the pipe broke. So there's a lot of, there are less dangerous things these days, I guess, than there were in the ancient times, but there's still a lot of stupid things that people could do, unfortunately, if they're ill-advised.
Well, that's right. You know, there's always an allowance for stupidity or gross stupidity.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I've seen people kind of attack a problem in the exact opposite direction. Unfortunately, survived it, but just barely. So, you know, it's I think YouTube is still rife with videos of people falling down and falling over and all kinds of terrible things. So sometimes people can be their own worst enemy.
Oh, no question about that. That's quite true. That happens all the time. You have to really take the time and analyze all the different points before you go ahead and attack it.
Yep. You got to have a plan. I tend to don't go into anything unless I have about 3 plans, just in case.
Yeah, you want to analyze everything, you know, before you go ahead and commit to doing anything at all, no matter what it is.
Well, you'd be surprised how many people just kind of jump into anything and just to see what the hell happens next.
Well, that's the true definition of stupidity.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but there's a lot of those guys out there. They mean well. It's just that happens to be their approach to a lot of things. You know, when you talk about having three plans, there's more than enough people out there who don't have any plan. They just kind of wing it.
Unless it's an emergency situation, when I hear someone say to me professionally, I'm just going to wing it, that scares me.
Well, yeah, if you ever have a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer who tells you he's going to wing it, go find yourself another doctor, lawyer, or engineer.
I totally agree on that point.
Okay, very good. Brian, I guess we kind of stomped on this topic as much as we could.
I believe so.
Okay, well, I will thank you for participating. And, of course, if anything else comes to mind tonight and we have the time, I'd be more than happy to interact and see where that one goes as well.
Your foresight and opinions are always greatly appreciated. So I thank you so much. So, anyone out here with us?
WA2CH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I was just wondering, on the case of the antenna for 2 meters wanting to use it on 440, before you do any snipping or anything, there is a possibility that as a three-quarter wavelength antenna, it might accept power and be usable, just like you can use a 40-meter dipole. You can load it up on 15. It acts as a three-halves wavelength antenna. There is a possibility, because it is the third harmonic, roughly the third harmonic, might accept power on 440 as well as 2 meters, just operating in a different mode as a three-quarter wavelength rather than a quarter wavelength antenna. Before you do any snipping, you might just want to check that. Maybe check it on a VNA, see how it looks there in the 440 vicinity.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, John. I mentioned that as well. I said, either the VNA, or you could probably use the radio, because most radios have safety features. You know, if it has an excessive SWR, it probably has a little alarm light, and not to do that anymore. I suggested that earlier as well, that you won't harm anything from just a very quick test to see whether you can get away with it, whether the efficiency of the radiating antenna is sufficient for your operating needs to save you the trouble of having to do multiple surgery. So I agree with you, John.
Oh, I must have missed your comment. I'm sorry. I must have missed you saying that.
It's okay, John. Once again, I'm AC2GS. Any other amateur radio related questions or comments or topics for tonight, please ID yourself.
Should I have a comment on that?
Certainly, Wesley.
Okay. There was an antenna W3DZZ. So it had a trap. Actually, it had a return circuit at the end of it. And then there was an extension of the wire. So if you have a vertical antenna, I thought, the Wilson antenna, you make it resonate at 70 centimeters and then extend it with the resonant circuit there and a piece of wire. It is resonating in 2 meters in the middle of the band, then it would work for two bands. So carried, extended with the simple resonant circuit. I put it in something that is waterproof or water resistant, and add some piece of the wire to make it resonate it too. But just my fault. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand, Wesley. Well, I mentioned earlier that, you know, you have your choice of either modifying it electronically, which is what you're describing, or modify it mechanically, which is the snipping. If you're interested in a dual-mode antenna and you're motivated to play around with electronic components to kind of build things, and then you got to weatherproof it. So it's a little bit more labor, and if you're primarily interested in 70 centimeters and not 2 meters, and you don't really want and or need it, but you just happen to have this radiator sitting there, then it's probably ultimately easier to do a little snip-snip. Yes, Brian.
Do you have a dipole? Does it radiate at the ends of the dipole and just the receive part is used across the length? Or does the whole antenna radiate on transmit?
Okay. There's an interesting concept called antenna reciprocity, which, among other things, suggests that reception and transmission are just mirror images of each other. So, you know, the way that RF waves are radiated from antennas is the same pretty much configuration that RF waves are absorbed and received. That being said, the entire element radiates to a degree. The nuance here is that most of the current occurs at the feed point. At the edges of your center-fed dipole, your current is next to zero. The voltage potential is highest at the end point, but the voltage potential is not the thing that creates RF current. The current is. So at the very near the antenna feed point is the maximum current and the maximum RF radiation. As it goes towards the edge, it trails off to nothingness. But ultimately antennas, the entirety of antennas radiate, and the entire of antennas absorb RF as receiving antennas. Again, in a reciprocal sort of way, due to reciprocity.
Understood, because I have an N-fed half-wave antenna, 72 footer, and I'm always looking for a way to go ahead and gain more from it, even though it performs very well. I don't think there is a way, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean, is there a way. Position is very important with NFEDs. You know, if you throw it on the ground, it's an NFED, but it's not a very good NFED. The high current point of a NFED is, again, the antenna feed. So that's where a lot of the radiating takes place. So you kind of would like to have it as high as you can. You know, you don't have to have the entire NFED the same height above ground, but if you're going to have anything high, you should have the antenna feed as high as you can. As it goes to the other end, that's the voltage peak. So you want the edge of your NFED to not be near anyone, because if you transmit, some guy is standing next to it, he might get an RF burn.
Okay. Interesting point of view. I heard from a couple of people that's saying, oh, really, all the radiation from RF is really concentrated on the end. And I said, I don't buy that.
Well, you know, they have to kind of explain why that is. I mean, it's not that difficult. You can get a free antenna modeling piece of software, and you can just describe different types of antennas. And if you do it correctly, it'll tell you where the currents are. And the places along the radiating antenna that have a high current have a high RF output. It's as simple as that.
Okay, I'll take that as gospel.
Well, it's what everyone who I failed knows what they're talking about has told me. And forums and other such. Antenna simulation software can be very fascinating. You should kind of look into it. I did. I wrote a series of articles based on 3D imaging outputs to kind of hopefully explain how antennas work a little bit better than the spoken word. But the antenna simulators, like I said, unless you want the most accurate models, are free. So it's something interesting to play with.
Any way you cut it, you can't beat the physics. I mean, the physics of the wavelength is what it is.
Well, among other things, it's a lot of things. It's the environment has an enormous effect on antennas. Where you place your antenna in relation to Earth ground can affect its resonance and its Q and its impedance and all kinds of fun stuff. So, you know, a lot of times people talk very theoretically of antennas in free space, which really means in space. I don't know about you, but I can't afford to launch any antenna into space. So I have to deal with the reality of what antennas do when you put them X number of feet above the ground, which is a significant thing to do to them.
Comment.
Yes, certainly, Wes.
I don't think it's enough to test for the frequency. Vectors that determine the size of the antenna. So you have a vertical dipole on the 10 story building, and you put the ground plane, ground plane, and you put the artificial ground. You put a piece of metal on the roof. It's going to work as well as the physical ground would be, plus you gain it because of the height of the antenna by the rock.
I don't think so. Again, unfortunately, we got a bunch of different things that are all called ground. And I think you're thinking of a counterpoise, really. Because you know, Earth ground is supposed to kind of soak up all the radiation. But a conductor is not going to soak that much up. It's going to reflect things and all kinds of stuff. So a counterpoise is sometimes considered to be a type of ground, but Earth ground is a different thing. So if you know, it's not quite the same as putting it down on the planet Earth. If it's up 10 stories and there's some metal there, it'll just act as a kind of a reflector, not as much of an absorber as the Earth does.
Well, I understand about and as a bounce. It's like the bounce. So, of course, we have a certain ground variation to clarify the difference between each one. You could say that you need to address your home system. I mean, it depends what you understand all it, but if we're talking about the antenna of the car body, the car body is your counterpoise, is your balance. Now you have an antenna on 10-story building that's a piece of metal and the middle is your balance on it. And if you have an antenna on the ground is your balance on it. You see the difference?
I'm not quite sure if you're saying balun or balance.
Balance, not balun, balance.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it just sort of depends. When you're in a car, primarily the car is a counterpoise. It kind of determines the direction of the radiation pattern. If it was a, you know, a flat sheet of conducting metal, it would radiate 360 degrees. But because a car is an irregular object, it will, depending upon where you place it in the on the surface of the car, it will direct more RF in a certain direction. You put the antenna in the back of the car, it'll radiate towards the front. You put it in the front, it'll radiate to the back. So it's a counterpoise that adds directionality, as opposed to an earth ground, which doesn't really give you any kind of directionality. It just exists there to kind of suck up everything.
Yes, I agree with you. I was just thinking from the physics perspective. If you have a balance, it doesn't make a big difference what kind of balance you have, as long as you have a balance. Back to you.
Okay, well, you know, a lot of our antennas are not, unfortunately, balanced. Even if we do have counterpoises, they're not quite identical. And so that's what kind of creates the radiation pattern distortions, the non-symmetry of the sort of attempt at balancing. So, you know, if you have two equal length wires in a half wavelength dipole, that's a balanced structure. You don't need any kind of a counterpoise. It works by itself. You could throw it into outer space and it would work just as well, if not better. Whereas most of our earth-based antennas tend to be imbalanced in some way and fed dipoles, verticals, 5/8 waves, all kinds of fun stuff. It's inherently unbalanced, and yet we maneuver with radials and counterpoises, and if you don't give physics what it wants, it'll just take the outer sheath of your transmission line and use it as a common mode counterpoise.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I was talking about a particular antenna, so my explanation was address the particular dipoles, let's say, that Wilson vertical dipole that is placed on the car, or let's say the dipole antenna, vertical dipole antenna that is placed on the 10-story building, or if it's placed on the ground. So I was just talking about a particular thing, and that how my comment should be understood.
Oh, okay.
A comment.
Sure, Brian.
Well, with certain antennas, you want to have a common noise filter, or also called the line isolator, because RF will fall back from onto the counterpoise and go ahead and go into the radio and other places in your shack. So that's a very good thing to have. It's called the line isolator, and you have it about 2 feet from your radio and connects in line, and that could do wonders. It's really an RF choke. That's one thing. The second comment I have is on earth grounding. That bull earth grounding is not the same because of soil conductivity types. They could be much, much different, and the conductivity in some soils is not the same as others.
Yes, you are correct. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at antenna simulating software, you can simulate a ground, and you can simulate, I think they give you something like 10 different parameters for different types of grounds, although I'm sure there's almost an infinite number of different grounds with slightly different characteristics. But yeah, I mean, most hams won't really call it a line isolator. That's kind of something that people go to Radio Shack and buy for their audio systems. Most hams will kind of know it as an RF choke. You're choking, you're applying an impedance on a non-differential current that's going in the common mode. You stick a big ferrite and some coils, and it doesn't affect the differential mode going through your transmission line, but the common mode that's reflected back onto the surface of your shield, being common mode, will be affected by the impedance, and it will offer a great deal of resistance to that current and limit the common mode currents from traveling back to your shack.
I couldn't have said it better.
Good.
Questions?
It almost sounds like you're asking for questions. Do you have a question, Brian?
Oh, I could always think up thousands of questions. Depends what field you want me to go ahead and create the question.
Well, amateur radio, also keep in mind that Wesley has a bunch of topics for tonight as well.
So let Wesley proceed.
Okay, very good. And if we have any more time at the end and you're so inclined, you could always come back. Wesley, what do you want to discuss for tonight?
I have a leak with six topics, actually it's 7-1, but most of them are very short. It's not going to take too much time. There was a subject of a Japanese scientist who made an invention of blue LED. It's a fascinating story about a Japanese man who didn't have a PhD fighting for something that changed the world from a single LED to color TV based on LED, and then OLED, and then street lights and your lights in your house, and eventually your smartphone. So there wouldn't be a smartphone if it's not him, or I assume there would be somebody else. Anyhow, the story is about the Nagma Tamura. He says that I was a child and that was born in a remote village in Chikakoku Island. There was no high school and no universities there. And then, all of a sudden, in 1993, when he invented high efficiency blue LED, there was a media that was coming to his house every year at October 7 in the midnight. They are probably their customs waiting for the Nobel Prize announcement, hoping. And eventually the guy got a Nobel Prize. The Suri Nakamura, along with two other Japanese researchers, let me drop. Dr. Isamu Asaki and Horisha Amano received in 2014, so it took 20 years later, a Nobel Prize in Physics in recognition of their major breakthrough in lighting technology. So that light that we'll have in your kitchen and your house that is so much energy saving is actually because of the work of this Japanese guy. At that time, there was a funny story because there was enough if he filed the five scientific papers. He was eligible in Japan to get a PhD in electronics or staging giving field. Not any longer. But Dr. Roy was talking about it many years ago. That story was still in progress. I would like to hear his comment.
I just mentioned that, you know, I think I went into this whole thing about band gaps and why different LEDs have different colors, probably. There was another time that I told the story of if you take LEDs and you kind of paint them black, how do you tell which one is the red, green, and blue one? And, of course, the answer is you measure the voltage drop. because the voltage drop across the resistor is not fixed. It depends upon the substrate. And that voltage drop does something and goes someplace because there's a conservation of energy. So if you take the voltage differential from the voltage drop, that voltage determines the frequency of the photons that are created. Early on, before people kind of even knew that much about solid state, regular diodes were kind of photoelectric. They emitted infrared, and they absorbed infrared and changed a little bit when you exposed them. So the manufacturers just kind of made an opaque cover for them. So, you know, it was easy to figure out an infrared LED. It was not that hard to make a red one. And then it got increasingly harder. And when they reached a good old blue, which everyone's favorite, still to this day, I think, it was priceless. And this guy was obsessed. You know, his company kind of dissuaded him because they hadn't seen sufficient evidence that he was on the right track, and they wanted him to do something else. And he pleaded and begged and worked on time off, I think. And the poor guy eventually comes up with the famous blue LED, which has made, I think, Nichia billions of dollars of profit. And I think they cut him a check for a couple of $1,000 as their gratitude. So the moral of the story is life ain't fair.
I see you got $170. In other words, he was working on a project and he was scrutinized in Japan in the firm that he was working for, manufacturer as well, and he was about to be thrown out from the job. He went to the boss and asked him for $3 million to work on it. Some money was given to the project, not to him personally. He went to Florida and he was working on making better the oven that was able to make the clear crystals, and that's the requirement for the blue light LED to be created. And eventually he was able to copy the existing oven and make the better one. And the nephew of the big guy took over the company, and he told him stop. So he was throwing those papers to the garbage till eventually he was told to stop completely. But then he showed that blue LED that is working, and the company made $80 billion in 1993 on it. Let me drop. So a few hundred dollars, even if he was paid $500, it's nothing. So eventually he decided that he's going to get out of it, went to the United States and started to sue the company for a small amount of money, but the court gave $186 million to be paid. The company from Japan decided to talk to that Nakamura guy, creators of LED, and eventually they paid him $8 million, which was actually barely covering the cost of the lawyers that were hired. Now we're talking about the Nobel Prize that he got. There were three guys all together, so we're talking about $1 million divided by three. And that's for his work that made the Japanese company very rich. But 20 years passed by, and now he's working on his own company. Let me jump. In November 2022, Nakamura co-founded Blue Laser Fusion, commercial fusion company with in July 2023, I'm reading, Blue Laser Fusion raised $25 million from French capital. And he's actually trying to make some money, but he is not young any longer. He was young then. He is only 2 years older than I am right now. So we're talking about the retirees, retiree who is eventually trying to get some pleasure of work, not of life. Back to you, Dr. Lang.
Yeah, in addition to, I think there, it's lawyers usually make the money, not you. But, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we've been here many times before. Brilliant people who've had breakthroughs, usually in their 30s, sometimes 20s, sometimes 40s. Seldom can you kind of jump back on that horse when you're late 60s, early 70s. Everyone has tried. Everyone has failed. You know, Linus Pauling, God bless him. I met him once. The man was kind of charismatic. There was a twinkle in his eye, and you just had a kind of fondness for the guy. His vitamin C research was complete bilge, complete nonsense. But, you know, something drives these people. They're looking for that fame that they came in contact with earlier. To my knowledge, the only guy who was a consistent producer through most of his life was Albert Einstein. You know, he published papers, for many, many decades. You know, he was not a flash in the pan. He didn't just do the photoelectric effect and then, of course, the special and general relativity and just sit there and stare at a blackboard for the rest of his life. He did Bose-Einstein condensates, all kinds of wormhole studies, all kinds of fun stuff. But, again, for most of us mortals, if we're lucky, we get one chance. So Nakamura had that one chance. I don't think he's going to reinvent the wheel. You know, there was a guy who had been instrumental in lithium battery technology, which is fantastic. But the same thing happened to him. He was going to revolutionize battery technology with something completely different. Well, he's dead now. He's not going to revolutionize anything. So, you know, it's a shame. But I think Nakamura had his one bright, shiny moment. I don't know if you transmitted anything, Wesley. I didn't hear anything. That's almost an absurd question. I mean, Richard Feynman kind of said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you're wrong. You don't. So with that in mind, it's very difficult. Fundamentally, it is about the wave nature of matter. That's how it kind of started. There's an equivalency, wave-particle duality occurs with all particles. Electrons are particles, but they can act somewhat like waves. Neutrons, atoms, you can have a slip a slit experiment, a double slit experiment that shows interference with light. But if you shine electrons, you can show interference of electrons. And if you throw atoms, you could show interference of atoms. So atoms experience wave-like phenomena. So this is the keeping in mind, using a wave equation to define quantum mechanics called the Schrodinger's equation, which describes not everything, but kind of probabilities of things. And so quantum mechanics is the quantization of everything. There's no continuum. There are small packets of everything, and there are probabilistic behaviors of everything. And so using equations to describe it, that's the fundamental basis for quantum mechanics. It's a much more complicated subject, though, obviously.
Yeah, I thought that in every language there is a way to explain things that seem to be difficult, but actually they are not. The quantum physics or quantum mechanics is not difficult. It's just different. So quantum physics is a broad term that includes all quantum phenomena and their application, where quantum mechanics refers to the specific models and theories to explain those phenomena. So quantum physics can involve experimental research, that's what I believe, and applied physics focusing how quantum phenomena can be utilized. That would I see as the differentiation between quantum physics and quantum mechanics, Dr. Wright.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, that doesn't explain anything. You could use the same explanation for anything and changing the title. It's kind of like quantum mechanics is all the stuff in a book called This is Quantum Mechanics. I guess to a degree, but it doesn't really get you anywhere.
Yeah, that's a good point. How about if I say quantum mechanics is a fundamental theory that describes behavior of nature and below the scale of atoms, and it is a foundation for quantum physics? Back to you.
Again, it's a kind of circular description. You have to be able to explain it without really using the term itself, because you're explaining it in terms of itself, which is circular.
Well, first, Mary has a name. So Mary, if I start from Mary, Mary is a blonde hair, whatever person. So then I have to at least once use the term. So if, correct me if I'm wrong. If I say quantum physics is a study of matter and energy at the most fundamental level, and it explains how everything works, including the nature of particles, forces, and interactions. Would that say something?
Well, I mean, it would kind of be an overview, but fundamentally, no one would kind of know what's the difference between that and Newtonian physics, because Newtonian physics kind of thought that they explain everything. Back in the weird old days, they thought that physics kind of, since it didn't have a basis in probabilities, everything was kind of set down. And if you learned all the variables of a system, you could describe that system for the rest of eternity. Unfortunately, quantum mechanics involves probabilities that screws that up humongously. So Newtonian physics can sort of be optimistically described as the same thing, except that it failed. This is a new attempt that is closer to, apparently, reality. We may not have reached complete reality. We may have reached only 98.3% reality, whereas Newtonian physics was 95%. So, again, it kind of broadly suggests what it is without explaining any aspect of it. You know, if you described it to to Einstein back in 1900, he wouldn't really be able to use that definition to get anywhere, I don't think.
Okay, thank you for that. So that means that if I mention Mary, I should say about the feature of the Mary. So she is blonde, she is slim, she is what and whatsoever, but if I try to apply the same mechanism to quantum physics, then I would say that the key point of quantum physics includes quantization, which is everything in the universe that is quantized. I mean, everything in the universe is quantized. Subatomic behaviors, where particles at the subatomic levels behave differently from classical physics, and that would be me pointing the differences. Then I should say about the state. So a particle exists in different quantum configuration called state. And then if we're talking about energy, I should say energy transfer. So the energy of electromagnetic radiation is transferred in discrete quantum packets known as photons. Did I miss something?
Well, you touched on some interesting things, but like anything, you know, it can get wider and wider and wider. And you mentioned that quantum mechanics is properties of subatomic particles, which it is. But it's also, to a degree, properties of atoms and occasionally molecules. And if you get a bunch of atoms together and you cool them down to, a nano Kelvin, that a cluster of 40 relatively heavy atoms can behave as a simple wave function and undergo behavior that's purely quantum mechanical. So you don't necessarily have to go into the subatomic to have quantum mechanical properties. You know, even you and I have a wave associated with our human body because of our massive mass and momentum. That wave characteristic is very minuscule and has no effect on almost anything. But there is wave particle duality even in our macroscopic world, although to such a negligible degree that it's undetectable whatsoever.
Yeah, I was by pointing, what was it, 4 points, I was trying to avoid something that would be requiring a certain knowledge in given art. So let's say another future would be according to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it is not possible to determine the position of and the moment of any subatomic particles with infinite precision. But then if I say that the person has to have any idea about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and about the momentum and about subatomic particles, so it looks like there is no way to explain to the random person what is the quantum physics right or wrong.
Right. I mean, you could kind of give them a very superficial understanding with a couple of fancy words. And if you're clever enough, you could make millions selling it as a popular science fiction, science nonfiction book. But, you know, I mean, that's why you have to go to graduate school and spend 10 years of your life trying to figure out some of this stuff. And still, I leave you with good old Richard Feynman, may he rest in peace, is a line that if you think you know quantum mechanics, then obviously you don't know quantum mechanics. It's a very, very problematic subject, and we're not kind of evolved to kind of deal with it very well, and so at best we can handle it mathematically because that's kind of taking a right turn or something. But we've evolved for this macroscopic universe where quantum mechanical probabilities and multi-states have collapsed down to simpler things for us to proceed. So it's kind of difficult to wrap your head around it. I mean, I try my best, and, you know, sometimes I think I get it right, and sometimes I probably get it wrong.
KF2CC?
Yes, Brian.
Brian is entering his first stages of narcolepsy. So I want to go ahead and wish everyone a very good night. And 73, very nice conversation. Look forward to joining you next week. And this is KF2CZ going 2RT, clearing the frequency.
Okay, very good, Brian. I mean, keep in mind that we just changed the clock. So although the clock says 9:53, your brain says 10:53. So I thank you, as always, for participating tonight, and I look forward to the questions you'll come up with in future technical nets.
I thank you very much, and yes, the hour does make a difference. Hopefully I will acclimate to that. All right, everybody, 73, have a good night. Thank you.
Okay, back to you, Wes. It depends upon how wrong you want to be. If you want the maximum number of people to think they understand what you're talking about, you're going to unfortunately have to simplify it to a point where a certain percentage of it is just incorrect. And even Stephen Hawking did that. So if you want people to have a thorough understanding as much as the author, they would have to have the same probably scientific training that the author had in the first place, which kind of kills the whole idea of a popular book on quantum mechanics for the everyday man.
I absolutely agree with you. So you agree that I agree, and I agree that you agree. We both agree. So let's go to the next one. I'm going to need the help of Paul from Space Report. I have actually two subjects that requires. It would be helpful if Paul would be able to comment on it. I sent two emails also to Paul. So ship-to-ship propellant transfer testing. The deputy manager from NASA flight program, Dr. Kent Hoynatsky, American spell it, his name, Ken Kenchaki. Okay. There is on the video that I sent you, there is an interview with him. So he talks about the ship-to-ship propellant transfer testing that will take place in March next year. That would be for SpaceX, or that could be actually for any kind of future spacecraft. So it's talking about the exchanging the fuel between the tank and the ship by sticking them together in space. That's a question to Paul. Can you tell us more about the process of fuel transfer? I would appreciate that, Paul.
Okay, yeah. Roy, let me see. Okay, very good, Wesley. Yeah, I saw that. By the way, the guy that does those YouTube, Marcus, he's pretty good. I've seen a number of his YouTubes. You know, a lot of them you got to worry about when you look at them. I don't trust him, but he's okay, that guy. But that's going to be a procedure that SpaceX is going to need to do to get their Starship eventually to the moon. The reason they have to get it to the moon is they need to meet up with Orion, the Space Launch System launched by NASA, in moon orbit, and then from there they'll transfer a crew to the Starship, and the Starship will land on the moon on the South Pole. And then after doing that, the Starship has to come back up, dock with the Orion again, and the crew transfers from the Orion and flies all the way back to Earth. And before they do any of that, the Starship will have to do it completely without a crew. They need to be able to duplicate this whole procedure to make sure it's going to be safe. So they need to send the Starship over to the moon, land on the moon, come back up off the moon. Now, to get that Starship to the moon, they need plenty of fuel. It's going to be launched by the Starship system, which involves the booster, with 33 Raptor engines. Each Raptor engine is over 50,000 pounds of thrust. You're going to wind up with over twice the amount of thrust of a Saturn V rocket just to get off the ground. And they need to put the Starship, which is the top part of it, into orbit. And that thing has to, once that gets into orbit, it needs fuel to get into orbit. So Starship's going to use up most of its fuel just to attain orbit. So now you need to fuel this thing. Well, to fuel it, let's put a gas station up in the in orbit. All right, so now before all of that happens, you're going to need to launch another Starship, which is a gigantic fuel tank. Now here's this thing in orbit with very little fuel in it. You're going to need multiple flights, maybe a half a dozen, depends on a couple of factors, to fill up that tanker. Once the tanker is full, then you can launch a Starship and then dock with the tanker, load up all the fuel, and now your Starship could go to the moon. And to do that, you'll need a lot of capabilities. You need to be able to dock two ships together and transfer two different fuels, liquid methane and then liquid oxygen. They use liquid methane on the Starship. Now, if both of them build up pressure. If you take, for instance, liquid oxygen, and you put that into a tank here on Earth, and then close the valve, that valve is going to go up to thousands of pounds of PSI. So when you see like a tank of oxygen and a tank of, let's say, of acetylene, sitting at a gas station or something, where a guy's going to use it as a torch, that tank, the oxygen tank, and it's always green. When you look at that tank, and if you look at the gauge, and if it was full, it would probably be reading like 3,400 pounds of pressure. Now, if you would take that tank apart, you'd find out that thing is really thick. I mean, like a half-inch wall on that tank, and that's the reason it doesn't explode. It's got tremendous back pressure inside. Well, you can't do that in space. You can't launch a Starship with this extra steel that heavy to be able to store that liquid oxygen in orbit. So the system that they use is they vent it. It's constantly being vented. Once the pressure gets up a little too high, it's bent up. The relief valve opens up and gas comes out, and it keeps that pressure relatively low. But yet it will be in a liquid form. Now they have to do this not only with liquid oxygen, but liquid methane. So that's why when I said it might take a half a dozen flights to fill up the fuel tank, the service tank that's going to be in orbit, is because it depends on how often you're going to fly them up. Over time, this thing is going to be venting it out over and over again. I've heard possible situation where, for different delays on Earth from flights.
K2NDR.
I've heard up to 30 different flights would be required to keep that tank, you know, constantly full. So it's a heck of a problem that they have that they're dealing with. And that's the reason NASA crossed that off the list in the early days of trying to, you know, get a spacecraft to the moon. You know, Saturn V went up, you know, with the Apollo spacecraft on top. Everything was all in one big launch, and off it went to the moon.